Silicon Valley. Workers from around the world helped build it, and foreign governments have salivated over it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace Tech, demystifying the digital economy. I'm Jed Kim, in for Molly Wood. We're continuing our conversation with Margaret O'Meara, whose book The Code is out this week. Think of it as a biography of Silicon Valley, all the circumstances over more than half a century that made it what it is today. A big part of that is people, engineers, tech geeks, politicians, venture capitalists, and a big number of those people were immigrants. O'Meara says a global talent pool was absolutely critical to Silicon Valley's success. She writes about a key moment when Lyndon Johnson signed immigration reform into law.
I knew that the 1965 Immigration Reform Act was going to be a, sort of a quote-unquote character in the book, because I think that's one of the single most important economic policy moves of the last 60 years and creates this new basis on which whole new waves of immigration, immigration that includes people who come from Asia, East Asia, South Asia to Silicon Valley, refugees from the former Soviet Union, from all around the world, end up in Silicon Valley and other high-tech regions. And they and their children become the not only the kind of the technological backbone of the valley, but they, in disproportionate numbers, found companies.
You make the point that a lot of nations have tried to make their own Silicon Valley success story, and it's really difficult. But despite that, there is a lot more overseas competition. I'm talking about China. They have a lot of successes right now and maybe leading in a lot of areas.
You know, the Chinese have looked carefully at the Silicon Valley example, and they have replicated some of the same, made some of the same moves, including really broad-based government investment in advanced technologies, whether it be autonomous vehicles or AI, or higher education, full stop. And these are things that the U.S. as a state is not doing in the way it used to.
You make the point at the end of your book that current and maybe future generations of tech workers, they may be walking away from the goals that drew a lot of people to the Bay Area. Can Silicon Valley last?
Well, that's a question that's been asked about Silicon Valley again and again. You know, there have been obituaries written for it in 1969, 79, 89, 99. It's always on the nines. So here we are in 2019. It's kind of appropriate. We're wondering, is it over? I'm made optimistic by the new generation of technologists who are saying, okay, there's more than just making money. Think about how technology can truly make lives around the world better, how it can be exported to other places in a way that doesn't disrupt and destroy institutions, but strengthens them. I think that they are, and they're also wanting a different quality of life. The Bay Area and my hometown of Seattle have become very expensive places. They're places that already had, you know, affordable housing shortages and transportation problems, and the current tech boom has just exacerbated all of them by several orders of magnitude. So it's a, you know, we are at an inflection point where the places that are tech hubs are really going to need to do something to figure out how to accommodate growth in a way that is more inclusive and that is going to be more resilient over the long term.
How do you see the threat of regulation when it comes to Silicon Valley? I mean, is this something that'll change the industry? Will this story look really different in 10 years?
Regulation doesn't have to be a threat. And I think that's one thing that the history can really help us better understand. There are many, many examples of regulation, antitrust enforcement that have proved very beneficial and generative to tech. AT&T antitrust cases, which, you know, AT&T's basically has been in an antitrust action most of its existence. And in the mid-50s, a resolution of the AT&T had been trying to sort of inch into the nascent computer industry and was swatted away by the Department of Justice. And in 1956, there was a consent decree that AT&T was put under that required it to license its the technologies that came out of its industrial research lab, the legendary Bell Laboratories. It had to license transistor technology for free. Gordon Moore, another founder of Intel, later said, we would have not had a silicon semiconductor industry in the Valley had it not been for this consent decree. Because what it did, it allowed these new companies, these new startups in the Valley and elsewhere, to start using transistor technology and, you know, building their own products. It was transformative. So I think there is a middle way, you know, how you can both have a really vibrant tech industry and allow people to be entrepreneurial, to make money, but also to allow for competition and innovation.
Margaret O'Meara's new book, The Code, is out this week. If any of you wants to make a tech podcast about some fascinating slice of Silicon Valley's history, this thing is going to be your Bible. And now for some related links. A ready and willing immigrant task force helped make Silicon Valley. Now more of those workers are migrating further north instead. Business Standard looks at the increase of Indian tech workers getting permanent residency in Canada. Last year, nearly 40,000 gained residency. That's an increase of 51% over the previous year. In the U.S., there's been a lot of uncertainty over H-1B work visas for workers with specific tech skills. Meanwhile, Canada is reducing how long it takes to process global talent visa applications from 6 months to just 10 business days. The U.S. and China have a firm grip on tech dominance. Korea Times reports on one person's hopes to challenge that. A former French culture minister turned startup incubator founder wants to link Korean startups with European investors. The aim is to make sure the world of tomorrow doesn't reflect only American or Chinese values. Business Insider looks at one startup CEO whose app helps low-income people in Brazil access credit. While he's attracted angel investment, he says raising capital has been tough. One factor, he's an undocumented DACA recipient. And he says potential investors weren't sure how that would impact the company's future. The VC world was also not so interested in lower-income customers without bank accounts. He says more diversity in the investing world is needed for ideas like his to take off. I'm Jed Kim, and that's Marketplace Tech. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.